choke points.
Let's go.
And we have two major developments in the West Seattle Bridge saga. Here's Chris again.
Yep, Mayor Durkin was supposed to decide next Wednesday whether to repair the cracking bridge, then replace it, or go straight to replacement. That is not going to happen now. The reason? The cost-benefit analysis has not yet been given to the community task force advising the mayor on what would be the best way to go. Member Peter Goldman says they need to see the actual dollar figures before they can make any recommendations.
I don't think that our task force would be equipped to make any kind of recommendation without having some kind of reasonable ballpark, not, you know, bids, but reasonable ballpark ideas of what things are going to cost. You can't decide to sell the used car unless you know how much a new car is going to cost and how long the old transmission might last.
The task force will get that cost-benefit analysis on Monday, an 80-page document. Former Mayor Greg Nichols says they need fundamental facts, like how long a repair would last or how much a replacement would cost.
Those are the kinds of things that she's going to need to make the call between repair and replace. And that's the kind of information we're going to need in order to give her our best advice as affected community members.
The task force also found out that some of the data that they have been relying on is not based on any measurements or real calculations. Engineers have said that a repair could last 15 to 40 years. The Hez City's Heather Mark says...
Those numbers, 15 and 40, are not the result of any modeling. They are the result of some assumptions that are based in the building codes that we use to build bridges.
And that's why city engineer Matt Donahue says it's still unknown whether a repair would actually work.
I think it's still too early to say that the bridge overall is in good enough condition to have a tolerable level of risk that repairs will work as intended if we choose to go that route.
And now, a week before the scheduled decision, there is a new potential option to replace the bridge at a much faster rate, almost as fast as the timeline for repair. Seattle Department Transportation head Sam Zimbabwe says a new contractor that's been brought on board has proposed a steel bridge, not a concrete bridge. This contractor built a bridge over Lake Champlain between New York and Vermont, doing it in just over 2 years on a span that's just a little bit shorter than the West Seattle Bridge.
Of ways that we might be able to change the dynamic that we're talking about when we talk about replacement and what that might mean from a time frame, because I think for all of us, a 5-6 year timeline is really very challenging to think about that a bridge would be closed for that length of time.
But to build that bridge on the East Coast, the contractor was able to skirt the environmental process and cut the red tape down from years to just weeks. Not sure if that's going to be palatable or even possible here in the Pacific Northwest and in Seattle. Task force member Dan Austin says it's really frustrating to be getting this information 7 months into their work.
I'm frustrated that with 11 meetings in at this point that we're still just hearing about a new possible option or a new build technology that we weren't given the information in week 10.
This new replacement option and full cost-benefit analysis will now be scrutinized by the group over the next few weeks. The mayor's office tells me that there is no official date yet for when the mayor will make her final decision.
Wow. So at least there is the possibility of a new bridge within a reasonable period of time, it sounds like.
Yes, there is, but it's got some hoops, especially on the environmental side. Not sure if we'll be able to do here what they did in New York, but we'll see. I mean, at least it's another option that gives folks a little bit of hope on getting a replacement done faster.
All right. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Over the years, we've covered this idea of universal basic income, basically handing people money as a way of preventing things such as homelessness. And in Canada, a group called the Foundation for Social Change has just wrapped up an experiment which involved giving homeless people a chunk of money, $7,500, see if that was better than using the usual welfare system. And Claire Williams is one of the co-founders and the CEO of the Foundation for Social Change, which is up in Vancouver, BC. Tell me how you designed this experiment, first of all, Claire.
Yeah, so first of all, thanks for having me here, Dave. We're thrilled to be talking about our work.
So the study was really designed as a randomized control trial because what we are doing is so bold and innovative and possibly triggers stereotypes that, you know, you definitely can't give people living in poverty a sum of cash. We wanted to make sure that we had the evidence base to demonstrate whether or not this worked. So we built the study as a randomized control trial working in partnership with the University of British Columbia. And we gave 50 people who are recently homeless a one-time cash gift of $7,500. And so the people who were screened into our project, they were randomly selected to either be in the cash or the control group. And then we followed people for a period of 12 to 18 months to collect data and see what happens.
So they were offered coaching, and all the participants, both in the cash and no cash group, had to show that they were not on any kind of drugs and also had to show that they were ready for change. So then these were not really chronic homeless people then.
No, we were not working with people who are chronically homeless at this time. Yeah, just because this is the first time anyone has ever tried this approach. So we wanted to start with a population that has a higher degree of functionality. And then in subsequent projects, relax our criteria and see if we can help more people.
Okay, so in the group that then got the lump sum of $7,500, what was the biggest change you noticed in them compared to the other group?
Housing. People within that 1 month of receiving the cash transfer, people very quickly moved into stable housing, which is quite remarkable given the pressures. There's a lot of housing pressures, affordability pressures here in the Lower Mainland, as there is in Seattle. So we were thrilled to see that this cash was really empowering people to move into housing faster and thereby spending fewer days homeless.
All right. So that's the first thing they spend it on. And as a result of that, a lot of things begin to fall into place, correct?
Yeah, exactly. So once they've moved into housing, we saw that people were spending the money on food, on clothing. People were using the money to get their car back on the road. So for a lot of jobs, you require a car in order to go to work, but you can't fix your car if you don't have a job to pay for those repairs. So a number of folks use that money to get their car back on the road. We also saw that people made really wise financial choices, and that counter to stereotypes, there was a reduction in spending on drugs, alcohol, and tobacco by 39%.
Wow.
And that's a pretty remarkable finding.
So you feel this shows that you can give homeless people a chunk of money and they will not just squander it. And it will. But the other thing you found is that overall, it saved the program money by getting people into housing sooner. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it saved taxpayers. So here in Canada, you know, we have, I think, a bit of a stronger, so a more rigorous social safety net than you do in the States. So here in Canada, it costs an average of $53,000 to $134,000 per person per year.
Wow.
For the duration of homelessness. So it's quite expensive. And so we found actually by giving people cash up front, we save approximately $8,100 in terms of people drawing on the shelter system.
I see. So the savings is calculated compared to what you would normally be spending on the social welfare system through the government's program.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. What I did notice in looking at your graphs is that while more people got into shelter sooner in the cash group, after 12 months, the two groups were just as well off after 12 months.
Yeah, you're correct. And I don't think we need to discount that. That's something that actually comes up a lot. And we've sat with that feedback and, you know, raises the question, is it worth doing it? But my response is absolutely. I have not spent one day in homelessness. I'm not sure if you have either or if any of your listeners have, but it's an incredibly traumatic experience. So the shorter we can make that period of homelessness, I think the better. And our research also demonstrates that if we want to prevent people from becoming entrenched in homeless, we need to provide meaningful support as close to the time of becoming homeless as possible. And one of the things that cash does is, one, it gives you dignity, but it also gives you freedom of choice. So when you look at the traditional approaches to homelessness, it's a fairly one-size-fits-all approach. And just like in the general population, the homeless population is not homogenous. People have different needs. So how do we empower those folks where cash is the biggest barrier so that they can move forward in their lives, which then reduces the pressures on the existing shelter system of care, which could then provide wraparound supports for people who need more support?
And that seems to be, that's the toughest problem, right? I mean, the people who are temporarily homeless and have some kind of skill and have a willingness to change, they'll get out of it maybe sooner with your program than they would if you didn't give them the cash, but they'll get out of it. It's the chronic homeless, though, and the people who just have decided for whatever reason to live on the streets and support themselves by shoplifting. This is the group that scares people. Are you going to tackle that?
I think we are. Yes, that's our plan, is subsequent programs to keep expanding our parameters. And I can't speak to the Seattle population. I know it's quite high. It's something like 12,500 people are experiencing homelessness in Seattle. Mm-hmm. Here it's in Vancouver, it's about 3,600. And the majority of that population is recently homeless. So I think the faster we can get people off the streets and into some form of stable housing and allow them to start moving their lives forward, then we can focus our efforts on these folks who need a little bit more support. And maybe it's more support and a cash transfer. That is an open question that we're excited to explore.
I'm curious, in Canada, was there as much aversion to the idea of just handing people a sum of cash as there seems to be here in the U.S.?
Absolutely. I think the stereotype around people living in poverty or in homelessness is pretty global, in that, you know, they're not going to make wise financial choices, that we in positions of power and decision makers know better what people need to move their lives forward. So, we had a lot of interesting conversations. And then some people are really open to shifting their mindset once they see the evidence and the data, and that this could actually empower people. And we have had some initial inquiries from Seattle. So it'll be interesting to see if we bring our work down there.
Good. I'm glad Seattle's showing some interest, because in the past, they've tended to say, oh, if we don't develop it here, we're not interested.
Yeah. Well, maybe because we're so close. I feel like we're sister cities.
Yeah,
so.
That's right. Good point. Yeah. Well, interesting experiment. And if you want to find out more, you can Google Foundation for Social Change, the New Leaf Project, and look at the data for yourself. But thank you, Claire, for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Time for your daily dose of kindness. It's brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. Firefighters have been protecting people across the country. You just heard wildfires are still burning in places like Colorado. They're fighting flames, of course, but also the heat. Cairo Radio's Miley Cady has the story of an act of kindness beyond the call of duty.
In Fort Lauderdale, Florida, an 80-year-old Army veteran was mowing his lawn when he started suffering from heat exhaustion. He passed out, and the local fire department was called. Crews arrived on the scene and helped him cool down. Once he was feeling better, though, they didn't stop there. The firefighters took it upon themselves to go above and beyond and finished mowing his lawn. Video of the good deed has gone viral. The department shared photos of the crew after a job well done, sitting with the veteran on his porch, out of the sun and enjoying the shade.
That was a sweet story out of Florida. I always like hearing about firefighters and police officers and other service members who go in above and beyond. It should just be required that we always mow lawns for veterans.
Why not? Now, from the Gene Ursula Show, which you can hear starting at 9 o'clock here in Cairo Radio, here is G. Scott. We will have breaking news later today, G, about $30 car tabs.
Hey!
U.S. Supreme U.S. Washington Supreme Court's going to rule on that. It sounds like you're a fan.
Yeah, I'm a fan. Why? Because that's what the people voted for.
Well, that's
twice.
True.
You know what I mean? So we voted for that. We need that, right? $30 tabs, you know, and especially right now. This was pre-pandemic, right? I felt a certain way about it. Now we're during the pandemic. I mean, what a beautiful time it would be to honor what the people voted for. Would be a great time, considering we care so much about what's going on in the pockets of our Washington constituents. Yeah. So,
and you're also cool with getting rid of all the stuff that the extra money would have paid for.
Dave, I knew you were going to go there.
I'm just asking the question. It's an innocent question.
Yeah, I'm okay with all those things that it was going to go pay for. I'm okay with those things coming from other places, considering we get taxed to death on all the other things here in the state of Washington. So, yes.
Whenever somebody poses that question that way, too, it makes it sound like the government are our parents, right? That it's like, this is what you get, or we're going to take it away. And it's like, no, we elected you to that position to figure out a way. The voters had to say they want $30 car tabs. Your job is to make sure our roads are drivable and livable. And so find another way. It's not going to be car tabs. That's how I feel about it. When you speak of the government, like what they say goes, and we're going to have to accept the outcome if we vote this way, no, it doesn't work that way. They need to put their creative minds back together and find another way to come up with the money.
I mean, I wasn't going to say take away from their own salaries. That wouldn't have been nice. But I tell you what.
Sure, you could reduce their salaries to zero. You know what? How much money that would raise? Pretty much zero.
Yeah, but yeah. How about this? You know, we can't really have that attitude as well, because we can't just all of a sudden say, well, this money is going to go towards fixing things, because there's a lot of things that we get taxed with, or there's an extra tax for this and that, and it's going to go towards this, and it's going to go towards helping this program. And let's be real. A lot of times, some of our money, it doesn't get used the right way in the first place. So this might help folks figure some things out, be more creative, like Colleen said, and start to figure things out. So until then, let's do this. Let's go back to what we voted for. Mm-hmm. It was $30 tabs. Mm-hmm. Let's put that back on the table, and mm-hmm. let's get it moving.
Okay.
Dave, what if I've never heard you sound so disappointed in me.
I'm not disappointed. I just have been through all this before, that's all. And I know how it works out. I know exactly how it works out. What you end up doing is raising the sales tax, which is the most regressive tax we have. Well, it is pretty regressive. But the nice thing about the tab tax is it roughly tracked people's income, because the more money you have, the classier car you buy. So once you get rid of a tax that used to track income, you end up with taxes that don't track income, and they usually fall on the people least able to pay. But if those people are cool with it, hey, I'm fine, because I make out like a bandit.
Okay, but Dave, do we really, you say you've been through this, and trust me, I do believe that you do, but we're talking about a society where the rich already get away with probably not paying that much taxes anyways. All they got to do is have good accountants. Fair?
Yeah. So we'll just pile on there. Okay, that's fine with me.
I'm so disappointed in you, Dave.
Well, I mean, this has been voted on before, as you know, and we did it, and that's what happened.
Okay.
We spent the rainy day fund. G. Scott, 9 o'clock on Carter
Radio. You're going to leave me like this?
Well, we're out of time. We're just flat out of time. You've got a 3-hour show to fill, man.
I love you, Dave.
You good? Conversation around police reform was the focus in Olympia yesterday as a panel of experts weighed in on what they believe the future of police accountability needs to look like. Here's Chi Radio's Hannah Scott with the highlights.
Senate Law and Justice Committee Chair Jamie Peterson hosted the nearly 3-hour discussion as he works on finalizing a wide-ranging bill for the upcoming session, expected to include everything from a new system to remove the certification of cops who violate the public trust, to bans on chokeholds, tear gas, and other accountability measures. There are also several other bills in the works. The question going into yesterday's meeting, what are the most important reforms to get to true police accountability? Manisha Harrell with the Coalition for Police Accountability among the speakers.
Once you see it, you can't unsee it. Do you remember George Floyd calling for his mother? For those who think respectability will save us, Manny Ellis's last words were, "I can't breathe, sir," even while he was being killed. He was trying to respect the officers murdering him. If this summer has showed us anything, it's that we can no longer kick this can down the road. It's not moral. It's not ethical. And our Washington communities will no longer be passive bystanders in another avoidable killing.
She laid out what the coalition is asking for.
We're asking for transparency and accountability. Independent investigations to ensure fair, unbiased, transparent investigations into the deaths of loved ones and community members. Stronger use of force laws to protect and preserve the human life we say we value. Real civilian input and oversight. This is part of our values as a government of checks and balances. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. The people being policed should have input and oversight into how that work is done.
Harrell says this is about more, though, than accountability.
It's about taking responsibility to ensure that we are preventing foreseeable negative outcomes from happening again. That we're actively learning, growing, evolving, and improving. Taking account and creating the change we need. And to that end, we must be honest with ourselves and others. Not every person is suited to every profession.
She pointed to the recent charges filed against an Auburn officer in the killing of Jesse Surray.
The officer who killed Jesse Surray was responsible for killing 3 people during his 12-year career. In addition, that officer had 65 incidents from 2011 to 2018. The earlier data in his files were not available.
An actual policy change is needed. We heard from former Seattle mayor and longtime city council member Tim Burgess, who's also a retired police officer.
The subject of police accountability is extremely important, and it impacts all of the people of Washington State. Policing our cities, our towns, our rural areas is a key obligation of government, and how we do that makes a difference in whether the public has trust and confidence in our police officers.
And he stressed,
I understand that policing is not easy. I personally understand that our officers are asked to resolve conflicts that society in general has failed to resolve. I know that officers often face dangerous circumstances requiring almost instant decisions. It's a tough job, and we need to honor and support our officers who serve with distinction every day, every shift across our state.
He pointed directly to the need for change in the collective bargaining and arbitration process when it comes to officer discipline.
One very important change is to eliminate the option to appeal police discipline to private arbitrators. It is not uncommon for private arbitrators to agree that misconduct in fact occurred, then rule that the punishment was too harsh, thereby substituting their judgment for that of the police chief or sheriff. The very manager who imposed the discipline and who is responsible for creating a culture of fairness and professionalism within the police agency.
On the law enforcement side, we heard from groups like the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs. Here's James McMahon.
Our first recommendation in use of force is to standardize the use of force policies and training centered on the cornerstone principle of the sanctity of human life. De-escalation, proportionality, and the use of time, cover, and distance should be emphasized. The required training from Initiative 940 should be accelerated. And this required training or curriculum should also include training on implicit bias in the history of race in law enforcement.
And they had a series of other recommendations.
Would require a supervisor to respond to any scene or call for service where any of 3 criteria are reported: the presence of a weapon, a person in a behavioral health crisis, or if any, the dispatcher or any other member of the agency indicates a high likelihood of the use of force. Require a supervisor to respond there.
And Hannah joins us live. So why should the law, when it comes to shooting and killing somebody, be any different for a police officer than for an ordinary citizen defending himself?
Well, I mean, that's a wide-ranging question. It's not, obviously, if there's an officer who intentionally, you know, with malice, tries to kill someone, then that's going to be something that they can be prosecuted for, as we're seeing now, especially that malice is removed as a barrier in our state law. But it's a different kind of thing. There's always the question of what a reasonable officer would do, right? So in sometimes when we see these deadly use of force cases, an officer can just say that, you know, they were in fear of their life. Did that person have a knife? Did that person have, you know, whatever the circumstance may be? So that the overall large discussion here is their job requires them to put their life on the line. So their rules for them are a little bit different because they have to protect themselves and, you know, whoever's in the community, right, when something like that comes up.
Since they're well-armed and well-trained, if anything, the bar should be higher. You could probably excuse an amateur for panicking in a self-defense situation and killing somebody, but a professional shouldn't do that. That's why we train them.
Right. And I think that the argument would be that that training hasn't been what it maybe is now. The thinking is that it needs to be, that there's always been that really kind of you can react fairly quickly and you can get away with it. Not that I don't think a lot of officers who do end up killing people in an force situation necessarily, you know, are happy that they did that. It's just their reaction. So there's better training, the more de-escalation training. It is not where it needs to be. So there's that. And then especially when we talk about implicit bias. So that's some of the other things we heard from the Washington Association for Sheriffs and Police Chiefs at this meeting yesterday, is we want to make sure that there's better implicit bias training, making sure that there's special training when we deal with people who are in a crisis, in mental health situations. So many of these incidences are people who are in a crisis of some sort, or perhaps on some sort of drug-induced state where they're acting really, really erratically. And that makes the officers somewhat fearful or overreactive in some cases, is the argument. So better training in that area so that there really is that de-escalation. And the first thing that an officer reaches for is not their gun for fear of something happening to them, really keeping the distance between them and the suspect and having perhaps a social worker or someone else out there for these types of calls.
There is Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your car tabs will not be going down. Let's find out more about this. Hannah Scott remains on the line. So I don't know if we've seen the text of the opinion yet, but does that mean that then it would be just a waste of time for Tim Iman to propose yet another attempt to get rid of $30 tabs?
To require
$30 tabs?
Yeah, he'd have to go through that entire initiative process all over again and try again. And it would, you know, you'd have to ask him whether he thought that was a waste of time. He's certainly done it in the past when he's tried to get $30 tabs passed before. What I can tell you is I'm just looking at the opinion right now. It's a done deal. They found that it violated the single subject rule. Primarily, the issue is that the initiative, while dealing with limiting vehicle taxes and fees, also required the retirement early or defeasement of refinancing those existing bonds, which is not connected, they said, to the vehicle taxes and fees. So that was the problem. The other issue was that the ballot title was inaccurate, and I'm still going through to see exactly what the specific issue was there. There was one dissenting opinion on that particular issue on the ballot title, but it was unanimous, it appears to be,
If that's the case. If you cannot require $30 tabs and also require that the bonds basically be, called in, because that's two subjects, that means you either have to run two separate initiatives or you can't do this ever again.
Right. And I would think that this leaves over, again, having went through this in its entirety, but those seem to be the issues that we're talking about, just the single subject rule and the ballot title being inaccurate. So those two things are the things that were found unconstitutional. And the reason that this has been shot down, it certainly would not, and I don't believe, keep Tim Iman or anyone else for that matter from trying to get another initiative on a ballot at some point in the future where you separated those things out and tried again. But that's not anything that's going to give anyone any relief anytime soon.
Now, Hannah, I know you're not a legal scholar. You're not a lawyer. The question that a lot of people ask me, and that I still have about, you know, the process and the things of the initiative, whole process, how can something even make the ballot if it's not a constitutionally written ballot statement? How does it even get that far if then afterwards we can just argue and go, oh, we didn't like this, so now it's unconstitutional? How does that work?
I think, you know, just given the arguments that I've seen in this case and the confusion I heard even during the oral arguments with the justices here, that is, there's just a lack of clarity on what exactly is going to end up being constitutional. They had to fight down this single subject rule argument all the way to the very end. And even as that Supreme Court hearing ended, I don't know that I felt that there was clarity on the part of the justices. It took them however many months since June when this was argued to come to this conclusion. So I think that perhaps some clarification in the law as to how that would work would certainly be welcome, because nobody wants to see this happen over and over again. I think this is, what, the third time, right, that we're going to get this passed and then it's going to be undone. It takes a lot of effort, a lot of taxpayer dollars, and it's disappointing to those who voted for it.
But in the meantime, Chris, isn't it true that the valuation schedule did get changed so even the higher car tabs should be more fairly priced?
Well, still, it's not anything close to reality. They moved them from 1996 version, and Hannah will correct me if I'm wrong, what, to the 2005 valuation, but nothing close to Blue Book or what people consider fair market value. But again, that's tied to the bonding, and that's the way Sound Transit was clever in this. To tie that to the money being paid back. But no, it's nothing close to what most people would consider fair.
Let me ask both of you one more question then. Is there anything, because people are going to be really angry about this, is there anything the legislature can do to make this tax seem fairer and to persuade people that they get value for their money?
They could change the valuation system to what was, you know, originally asked. Some of the things that we saw, you know, closer to Kelley Blue Book, basically, right? To exactly what Kelley Blue Book is, because that uninflates the car tab fees that you end up paying. But look, we tried to do that at least 3 years, if not 4 years running in the state legislature, and that's never come to pass with this ruling. I can't imagine that it does, especially given the situation we're in now with the funding issues because of the, you know, shortfalls because of the pandemic and all of that. So I think that would be a hard sell this time around.
And I would also
remind me too. Sorry, Sully, go ahead.
I was going to say it will also take some intestinal fortitude and actual leadership out of the governor's office to basically do what Governor Locke did back in the day, call the legislature back and say, listen, we know it's terrible. The Supreme Court did this, but this is what the voters wanted, and let's make it happen. But that is not going to happen out of the current legislature and out of the governor's office.
Well, and reading Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan's statement, too, saying justice for Seattle voters, you know, if you're one of those voters who wanted $30 car tabs, which in many counties that was the case, it sounds tone deaf to say this is justice for voters. So was it Seattle that actually voted it down? I remember there was a slim municipality that said, no, we're okay with paying hundreds of dollars.
No, well, the King County voters on the whole definitely voted against $30 car tabs, as, you know, conversely, they voted very much for ST3, which is what led to our inflated car tabs. So that was definitely it. But that's one of the other arguments here, too, is that you put this affected mostly people in the ST3 district, right? The people who have to pay for that light rail extension. But this vote on $30 car tabs was put out across the state.
Right.
So you had state voters kind of deciding for things that really impact those of us here in the Puget Sound area and in that transit district. So that's something that I think might be argued in the future against this kind of a vote.
Adam Scott. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.